The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey there, Takeaway listeners. It's Friday, August 26th, 2016. Do you want to be part of this show? Send us a voice memo at takeawaydigital@gmail.com.
Welcome to The Takeaway on this Friday. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. Well, Hillary Clinton had a tough week. A judge ordered the release of 15,000 more of her private emails, and she faced criticism, a lot of it from her own side, over donations to the Clinton Foundation. If Hillary Clinton wanted to change the subject, she had a sensational way to do it yesterday. In a speech in Reno, Nevada, Clinton was on the attack against Donald Trump and his own history of racial bias, but also turning everyone's attention to the connection between Donald Trump's campaign and the alt-right, a mostly online movement closely aligned with white nationalism.
There's always been a paranoid fringe in our politics, a lot of it arising from racial resentment, but it's never had the nominee of a major party stoking it, encouraging it, and giving it a national megaphone until now.
It was a remarkable speech in a lot of ways. It had bipartisan praise for people like Paul Ryan, George W. Bush, and Bob Dole. Instead, Clinton drew a short line from Donald Trump to forces that for decades after civil rights and voting rights and Jim Crow have been outside the American political consensus. The alt-right is on the rise and is, to its own surprise, at the center of American politics now. Rosie Gray is a politics reporter for BuzzFeed News. She's been covering the rise of the alt-right movement for years, and she joins me now. Hi, Rosie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, Donald Trump suggests in a way that the alt-right doesn't exist. Nobody knows what it is. It does exist, and we do know what it is. What is it?
Well, the alt-right is basically a movement that really got its beginnings online in communities like 4chan, Reddit, etc., but also draws from sort of older strands of white nationalism as well. It's basically a white nationalist movement that really rejects modern movement conservatism while also rejecting the left, rejecting globalism. And, you know, they're very interested in, you know, the hardline immigration stances that Trump has taken in the past, though that might be changing.
And you've been writing about how thrilled they are for the attention now, but also to be put at the very center of a presidential campaign. And we should say at the center through people like Steve Bannon, the CEO up until a week ago of Breitbart News. What's the connection there?
Well, right. I mean, I think that's really a key point here, which is that, you know, Steve Bannon, who up until last week was running Breitbart, is now at the highest levels of the Trump campaign. And I don't know whether Steve Bannon would necessarily describe himself as alt-right, but he has said in an interview that under him, Breitbart was a platform for the alt-right. So there's certainly been, Breitbart has certainly sort of embraced that movement. And now you can draw sort of a straight line between them and the Trump campaign.
And we're going to talk in a minute about immigration policy and how Trump has been shifting on that. And you just mentioned, Rosie Gray, that up until now, the alt-right has been reveling in their connections to Donald Trump. But this is a week of shifting immigration policies and rhetoric for Donald Trump. And to the alt-right, this is kind of, as you've written, their best week ever and maybe part of their worst.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that really drew them to Donald Trump in the first place, and one of the reasons why they've really felt like they kind of found their voice electorally through Donald Trump, were his positions on immigration. Now that it seems like he's softening in his words, although, you know, last night he said hardening, so we're a little bit up in the air where this is all going to end up. But the point is, they are now not quite as sure that this is that their values are being really reflected here. I spoke with Richard Spencer, who's one of their leaders, yesterday, and he said basically that, you know, if Donald Trump backs down on deportations, he's off the train. Those are his words. He's off the train. So I do think that it's a very fraught moment for them.
In the end, Hillary's attack seemed like it might be wonderful for the alt-right. They're getting a great deal of attention now. They're getting a huge amount of attention on the internet. People are talking about them. There's a legitimizing effect of a recognition that they're attacked by the person they hate the most, which is Hillary Clinton. But also pretty terrible for Trump to have this connection drawn so starkly in front of Americans who may not have heard of the alt-right before.
Right. I mean, you know, obviously from the alt-right's perspective, it's a good thing, you know, to get any kind of publicity. And obviously there will be people, because of that speech, Googling it, finding out about it, and some percentage of those people will think, oh, I agree with this. From the perspective of how it hurts or does not Trump, I mean, there's already been a pretty widely held perception that's been borne out in polling that he's viewed as racist. So I think this could compound that, but it's not necessarily going to be very new information for a lot of people.
Does it highlight, though, the strictures of the Trump campaign? I mean, his rise to getting 13 million votes in the Republican Party, fueled by a new brand of populist conservatism, is now in a general election. And it seems like Hillary Clinton's strategy here is to show everybody what that strategy really means for the broad middle in America.
Right. Well, one of the problems the Trump campaign has had so far in the general election is that they really have not been able to reach out beyond their base. And part of what Hillary Clinton was trying to do with that speech yesterday was not only cast Trump as racist, but in doing so, to reach out to voters that wouldn't necessarily be her voters in a normal year. So she made an explicit appeal to moderate Republicans, for example. So that was part of the goal there.
And part of the goal there, yes, is to show moderate Republicans all over the map that this is not a normal election. This is not your normal Republican Party. There are people running the show who even if you don't like me, America, even you shouldn't be comfortable with. Rosie Gray is a politics reporter for BuzzFeed. Read her reporting on the rise of the alt-right. It goes back years, and it chronicles the rise of this movement from the fringes of the internet to the center of a presidential campaign. Rosie Gray, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, the alt-right's number one issue, without question, is immigration. They are pro-deportation, anti-amnesty, and in general, big proponents of getting undocumented immigrants out of the country. And it's the big reason why so many of them say they found a home in the Trump campaign. Of course, Donald Trump still promises to build that wall between the U.S. and Mexico. But his other immigration rhetoric has meant a lot more among his alt-right supporters and among everyday voters. Trump has said that undocumented immigrants have to go. He's eviscerated his primary opponents, even Ted Cruz, for being too soft on immigration and wanting what he called amnesty. But now, in this general election, the foundation of Trump's campaign is shifting. He still says he's building that wall. But last night on Anderson Cooper, Trump said this.
There is no path to legalization.
You talked about paying
unless
back
people
identity.
Leave the country. Well, when they come back in, if they come back in, then they can start paying taxes.
So they still have
but
to leave the country.
But there is no path to legalization unless they leave the country and come back.
In the 24 hours leading up to that statement, Trump has seemed to hedge on the issue of amnesty and deportation of all of the 11 million undocumented immigrants. He met with Latino leaders to show some outreach to that community. Maria Rodriguez is the executive director of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. She did not meet with Donald Trump this week, but she had this to say about his outreach.
He's been insulting and battering us for about a year. This talk about the wall and the deportation, all of this is an offense to all American families. The problem is not just Trump. The problem is the Trumpistas, the folks that he has manipulated through fear and or literally bought out, like the Hispanic spokespeople. It's a dangerous situation, scary, and we should take note.
So to try to have a discussion here about where Trump currently stands on immigration, you kind of have to take the very last thing he said. There were different messages on different cable networks yesterday, and that, more than anything else, seems to reflect just how little wiggle room Trump has on this issue in a party whose primary and whose campaign team has moved very far to the right on immigration. Elise Foley is here. She's politics and immigration reporter for The Huffington Post. Hi, Elise.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this has really been a moving target lately, one that Trump has kept, I think, intentionally ambiguous. The wall is still there, as we mentioned. Mexico is still paying for it, as we mentioned. But then, as we heard, Trump has gone on Fox News. He's gone on Hannity last night and suggested that he was open to this idea of a pathway to citizenship for at least some undocumented immigrants. So help us out. What do we actually know now about where Donald Trump stands on the big questions of 11 million undocumented immigrants, how many of them can stay and how many have to go?
Well, I think, like you said, it's a moving target. So I don't think that we know exactly what he would do if he were in office. And one of the frustrating things is trying to parse his words. He said so many different things. So he said that he might be softening. He's also said that he thinks that everybody needs to go and they might be able to come back. So I think the biggest question here is, what he would do if it is not mass deportation and it's not some sort of path to legal status. And I think the thing that people are forgetting is that those are not the only two options. One of the options is just acknowledging that deporting 11 million people isn't going to happen and doing nothing about giving them any legal status, just leaving them in limbo.
I mean, Donald Trump has made other statements saying deporting 11 million people, gosh, that's awful hard. We can deport the criminals, but everyone else, that's awful hard. Is he coming to terms in front of the country with the fact that his rhetoric from the primary, deport them all, is untenable?
Yeah, I think so. And I think he's sort of testing the waters. You saw the other day he polled the audience and said, well, what should we do? Should we do this? And got applause. And then he said, well, what should we do? Should we allow somebody to stay, maybe work with them if they've been here 25 years and haven't committed any crime? So I think that he is testing the waters, queuing people up for making this shift that he is going to have to make if, you know, he's going to be realistic as a president. I think even the people who want large-scale deportations are not really calling for what he talked about before, deportation forces sending everybody out of the country. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think he is needing to make this rhetorical shift both at a policy level, which I don't know how strongly he cares about that, but then also at a political level because it's off-putting to people. Whether he can do that, save face, this late in the game, I don't know. I think probably not.
And the political situation is remarkable here because it's normal for any candidate to moderate their tone or policies in a general election. That's normal American politics. The thing here is that Donald Trump doesn't have any political running room. The rhetoric of the Republican primary shows a Republican Party that wants a very tough stance, basically a no-tolerance stance on immigration. It's fine for Trump to soften, as he calls it, to be more palatable to moderates, but then he's got a huge problem.
Deporting 11 million undocumented people, that is something that goes a lot further than what a lot of people have said. So it's just really hard to walk it back. And a lot of the people who applauded him for going that far are, you know, going to be furious if he backs away from that, so because it would be so extreme.
So how will we know, though, whether Trump bleeds support on the right for this? I agree with you. It's unlikely to be droves of conservatives who throw up their hands and vote for Hillary. That's not going to happen. But couldn't they just become tepid and unenthusiastic?
Definitely. I think one big distinction, though, is the distinction between the Ann Coulters of the world and then just the regular people at his rallies. So I know that a lot of reporters have gone around at his rallies, ask people about this. And a lot of people feel strongly, yeah, build the wall, you know, get them out. But then when you ask them about some of the policy specifics, you present it to them like Donald Trump did when he was polling the audience last night. Okay, so there's somebody who's been here a long time, they have kids, something like that. I think a lot of Trump supporters even say, okay, well, yeah, you know, maybe. And so I think that people aren't necessarily as hardline on it when they get down to the specifics as we might think from the outside. I mean, polling has shown that there is majority support for that type of policy in the country as a whole. So I don't think when you get to the specific people, people are as hardline. I think it's just rhetorically, and when you talk in broad strokes, mass deportation, building a wall, that sounds good to people.
Elise Foley covers politics and immigration for Huffington Post. Thanks, Elise.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Hillary Clinton's speech linking Donald Trump to the alt-right comes at a time when he says he's trying to broaden his support with Latino, but also with African-American voters. That outreach has included meetings with minority leaders and appeals to voters. But softening on issues like immigration could actually be more about winning over white moderate voters who, for any of its other virtues, are uncomfortable aligning themselves with a Trump campaign they see as having racist overtones. About 11% of African Americans are Republican or Republican leaning. Donald Trump is polling much lower than that in most surveys. In some, his support among African Americans hovers at close to zero. Leah Wright-Rigueur is assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. She's also author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Leah, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, you've seen Donald Trump's self-described outreach to black voters, and you've heard some of his rhetoric. You walk down the street and you get shot. Your neighborhoods are crime-ridden. What do you have to lose? What do you hear in Trump's words when he says these things and says that they're aimed at warming black folks to his campaign?
Sure. Well, you know, outreach is always going to be a good thing. Both presidential campaigns should always do outreach. But when you hear it coming from Donald Trump, it sounds insincere, given the candidate's history, given the fact that he's shown very little interest in African Americans up until this point, and given the fact that he has offered no policies, no prescriptions for actually addressing the very things that he's talking about. And he's right to say that poverty and inequality is something that we should all be concerned with. But given the fact that he can't accurately diagnose the problem, one can have questions about, you know, what does that mean for him actually being able to solve the problem? Right now, we don't really know because he hasn't really offered any solutions for solving the problem.
Well, you've written about black Republicans and how they view politics and black voters in general. Does any of what you've seen so far betray an honest effort to really convince black voters to vote for him? Or is it about something else?
Well, it's all of the above. And I think the thing that we've seen before is that Republican candidates, including Barry Goldwater, over the last 52 years, have done some measure of black outreach. You have to, because in order to win presidential elections, not only do you need some element of the black vote, but you also need to pull in some element of, you know, white moderates and white liberals in order to broaden your coalition. And this is on both sides of the aisle. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that one of the things that black Republicans in particular have been very adamant about, you know, for over 50 years, is that the candidate that the party puts forward should not be one that is either racist or dabbles in racism or opens the door for racism. So Donald Trump has put black Republicans in an incredibly difficult position, not only through his actions, things like birtherism, the Central Park Five, the Department of Justice housing discrimination, employment problems with Latino and black employees and other things, but he has also put them in an awkward position by continuing behavior on the campaign trail that suggests that, you know, there is space within the so-called Party of Lincoln for people who may have racist views. So we can look at things like retweeting white supremacists, black and Latino protesters getting beat up at Donald Trump rallies, arguing that African Americans have nothing, that their cities are destroyed, that they as a people are broken, that they really have nothing to lose at this point. So these are all of these things that put kind of black Republicans in this place and really alienate African Americans from whatever message Donald Trump is trying to sell.
And Hillary Clinton and her team seem to know this because she gives a speech yesterday that she highlights all of these things in very stark terms, putting Donald Trump shoulder to shoulder with the movements that he's aligned himself with the people that he's retweeted, with the factions of the nationalist racist right who are thrilled about his candidacy. I mean, she seems to know that this is going to turn off these very people.
Well, there are a couple of important things. One, this puts Donald Trump on the defensive. Two, in addition to kind of connecting him to this kind of mainstreaming of this movement, she also outlined a history and a pattern of behaviors by Donald Trump himself. So this is not just association, right? Guilt by association, but this is actually kind of reminding people of all races of who Donald Trump is.
You know, for a lot of people who are watching this race closely, though, Donald Trump's outreach to African Americans looks like something else. The message looks a lot more like moral cover for wavering white voters who are uncomfortable with all of these aspects of the campaign and don't want to feel racist if they vote for Donald Trump. And so this outreach is cover for them, not really designed to convince black voters that he's the one to vote for.
And there's, you know, there's considerable political science language studies and polls and a lot of history, including in my own book, where I talk about how candidates of both political parties benefit amongst white moderate and liberal voters when those voters believe that the candidate, you know, is not racist. Right. So there is a benefit. There is a political and strategic benefit to showing that you are compassionate, that you are empathetic to minority issues. So it does provide a certain kind of coverage. Right. And again, this is for both political parties. Where the difference comes in, though, is in a display of genuineness. Do voters on the ground across all races believe that the candidate is actually genuine about their outreach in investing in these causes? In the case of the Republican Party, we've seen varying levels of success. Some Republicans very successful because there is a belief across the board that this is a person who is genuinely concerned and empathetic to minority communities. In the event that there is very little evidence or that the person feels a little like a Johnny-come-lately, we see that it does not work as well.
Donald Trump is trying to show outreach to black voters. Hillary Clinton, in the meantime, seems to know what she's up to, and she gets right in his way with her own speech on Donald Trump's nationalist and white racist coalition, trying not to let him provide any moral cover for this outreach to African-American voters. It's a fascinating political dynamic. Leah Wright-Rigger, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, coming up, we're talking about the recent online attacks against SNL and Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones. This week, it got so bad, the Department of Homeland Security started investigating. We asked you, when should governmental authorities get involved in online harassment?
This is Ann from Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Facebook, Twitter, etc. authorities should get involved quickly. As soon as they see traffic spikes to one account or a single request from a user, and then they need to call in the legal authorities.
Online protection, First Amendment free speech, all issues here. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. And there's much more at our website at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
We've been talking today about the presidential campaign, Donald Trump's championing of white nationalists, and how this campaign is dealing with the text and subtext of race. Well, a couple of leading characters of the white nationalist alt-right movement have played a part in a very ugly episode outside the campaign, too. Comedian Leslie Jones was the target of racist attacks on Twitter, so vicious that a few weeks ago she fled the platform. Leslie Jones is known for her work on SNL and Ghostbusters. Last month, Jones briefly quit Twitter after facing a barrage of racist and sexually explicit tweets. Twitter eventually banned Breitbart News tech editor Milo Yiannopoulos from the site for life after he apparently led those attacks against Jones. Now this week, Jones's personal website was hacked. The perpetrators posted nude photos of her along with personal information and images of gorillas. The site has since been taken down. The Department of Homeland Security says it's launched an investigation into the incident. So why has Leslie Jones been targeted so viciously here? Here to help answer that question, Sherelle Brown. She's Community Engagement Director for the African American Policy Forum. Celebrity harassment is nothing new, but Brown says the attacks on Leslie Jones have been more vicious for a lot of reasons.
Well, there's a few things at work here. We know that there's sexism. Of course, about 70% of online harassment cases are women. And of course, there's tried and true racism. But what's really stoking the flames here is you have a successful black woman who is confident, who is taking up righteous space, who has full lips and dark skin and has so much joy. And so when you have a black woman who is that confident at the confluence of all these isms of racism and sexism, I think there's nothing more threatening or disruptive than a black woman who's doing well for herself and refuses to leave.
That brings me to some of the imagery that's mm-hmm. been hurled mm-hmm. at Leslie Jones, mm-hmm. which is hard for me even to talk about right. with you. I'm going to. Lots of images of gorillas hurled at her online and on Twitter before she left Twitter and before she came back. The roots of this.
For one, white supremacists need new material. These are age-old stereotypes and tropes. Dating back to slavery, travelers would go to Africa and describe the women there as gorilla-like or ape-like. But again, being confident in her beautiful dark skin and full lips and features that white supremacy deems as ugly. So you have memes comparing her to Harambe the gorilla. Is this move to kind of strip us of our humanity?
And so now we're in a presidential election where the CEO of the news outlet that Milo worked for, he was one of the ringleaders, as I mentioned, of this racist campaign is now at the center of a presidential campaign. These attacks happen all the time, but we're used to them being on the fringes of society. And it's easy for us, I think, to keep them there in our minds.
Right, exactly. There's this vocal fringe of the right who are, I think, free speech activists is what they call themselves, who simply are campaigning really for space to be bigots without accountability. And so you have a presidential candidate like Trump, who is now kind of making space, this national platform, sort of a vessel for them to kind of spew their bigotry and their vitriol.
We're about to say goodbye in our politics to one of the most famous black women in America, to Michelle Obama, attacked by a lot of people, maybe in a different way, I think, than Leslie Jones, or at least not quite as publicly. How does that strike you, the end of sort of the Michelle Obama era now, at a time where we're talking about this horrible mass media attack on an actress like Leslie Jones? Mm-hmm.
For one, I remember back in 08 when I was a freshman working on the campaign and seeing memes comparing Michelle Obama to an ape as well. Again, I think that the more we kind of move to the left or move forward in our politics and as a society, you have this kind of rubber band effect that kind of pops back. We had 8 years of the Obamas, and now there's this pushback from the right.
I want to try to leave this in a positive place. Sure. And I wonder, with all of this awful harassment that we're talking about, if there isn't an upside. There is no way to deny, when you have the internet, when you have a campaign like this and you have conversations like this on the air, that this type of stuff not only is out there, but it's at the center of a lot of what we talk about in politics.
Yeah, I think that the bright spot is that people are losing, that racists and sexists and white supremacists are losing, and they're not well right now. And they know that. And I think that's why we have this very violent response that we do.
Sherelle Brown, Community Engagement Director for the African American Policy Forum. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, the series High Maintenance proved it a few years ago. The web series is a great place for budding writers and directors to make new shows with low cost, no frills, and no interference. More and more, web series are a way to tell stories that might not get greenlit by big networks or big online producers. And it's a model that's worked for series like Broad City and Billy on the Street. Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker is here to fill us in on the web series that could make the big jump to TV one day, starting with one called Her Story.
Her Story is a web series created by a few women out in Los Angeles who wanted to tell the story of two women looking for love. One is transgender, and they are just kind of following the stories as they unfold.
I'm Allie.
I'm Violet.
Hi.
Bye.
You are the first trans woman I've ever met.
That you know of.
What do you mean?
You've probably met women who are trans who just didn't disclose to you.
The interesting thing about this is that they looked at places like Amazon and Hulu, but they really wanted to make sure that the show had as few barriers to entry as possible so that people around the world could watch it without having to necessarily sign up for Hulu or Amazon. And the show has kind of surprisingly managed to snag an Emmy nomination, going up against big hitters like AMC and Adult Swim. And a lot of people are looking at it to possibly win.
Is this the first ever Emmy nomination for a web series like this?
Well, the Emmys have started to look at web series and sort of digital content a little bit more, but this is, I believe, the only one nominated in the category this year as a fully independent web series.
All right, that's one to keep an eye on. Now, Cannabis Moms Club is a new series about stay-at-home moms who accidentally reveal their love of smoking pot. Weeds is another show that sort of had a suburban mom who surprisingly was a pot dealer. Is this similar or?
It's not quite Weeds because they're not really dealing, but they just kind of get together and get really high. Now, I'm reporting this week from Portland, Oregon, where cannabis is, of course, completely legal for recreational use. So this show popped out to me, and it looks pretty funny. It's produced by Elizabeth Banks, who has great comedic bona fides, as they say. And the show, based on the trailer, looks awesome. I can't wait to watch the first series.
Now, you told me that Crunch Time is one really to watch, especially for people like me who are huge fans of Stranger Things, which we seem to talk about it all the time. We can't get away from it. But Crunch Time is high on your list.
It has incredible cast of like Sam Levine from Freaks and Geeks and Avery Monson, who's been a little bit in everything. And it's a kind of sci-fi thriller, sort of part weird science, part, I don't know, RoboCop. There's some time travel. It's a complicated premise, but it's really, really fun to watch.
So it's a machine that allows you to place yourself inside another person's mind.
Sure. In layman's terms, I guess you could put it that way.
So you go inside Hannah's head? How does that even look?
it looks exactly the way I designed it to look.
It's well produced, and it's going to be streaming exclusively, I believe, on Rooster Teeth is the name of the network. And this is one of their first forays into this genre, and it looks like a really fun show. I've seen a few of the episodes, and I'm addicted and can't wait to watch the rest of them.
And finally on your list, Melissa, is Stare at Shannon. Now, Shannon DeVito is a disabled actor. She was also at the Democratic National Convention while we were there covering it, but she was there for a different reason.
Shannon just kind of goes around and does these kind of funny sketches and pranks. And when she was at the DNC, you may have been reporting on the Democratic National Convention, but she was reporting on it as Comic-Con. And she was going around asking people, like, how long it took to put on their delegate makeup and, you know, just being really, really funny.
Who are you dressed as?
I actually got the idea from the forefathers of our country.
Oh!
They had a real sense of fashion about them.
Interesting. Where's your wig?
The series has been going on for a while, and she's just really trying to take back the idea. I mean, she named her series Stare at Shannon because she just realized that people were going to stare at her one way or the other, and she may as well just kind of own it. And if they're going to stare at her, she may as well do something really interesting. And Shannon DeVito's also been kind of making a foray into acting. She showed up on Difficult People, which is in Hulu series, which is also pretty fun to watch. And she, I think, is going to be seeing a lot more of her.
They're brief, they're snappy, they're DIY, they're cheap. They're available. They're web series. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, and for us here on The Takeaway. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Todd.
There's this tradition, you know, I mentioned it earlier this week, where the incoming president, when they first enter the Oval Office on their first day, they find a sealed letter on the desk from the outgoing president. Private, not even classified. This is for presidential eyes only. All this week, we've asked you to write your own message to the incoming president about what's most important to you, or simply give a little wisdom.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Allentown, Pennsylvania. I would like to ask the next president of the United States, we must address economic inequality, because in my opinion, it is the driver for the violence we are witnessing.
We've also been speaking with writers who did their own messages to the new president as part of Poets and Writers' Dear President Project. Here's writer Dwayne Betts earlier this week. He crafted a message on the old epithet super predator and how it persists today.
It's a connection between the rhetoric and the policies and the inability for us to imagine young folks who get in a bad spot to be able to overcome that.
Well, instead of focusing on any one issue, writer Ocean Vuong asked the next president to use language that unifies people, avoiding the rhetoric of division.
No language is neutral. To speak is to claim a life, and often our own. If more Americans speak to one another in writing, in media, at the supermarket, we might listen better. It is difficult, I think, to hate one another when we start to understand not only why and how we hurt, but also why and how we love.
Ocean Vuong is the author most recently of Night Sky with Exit Wounds and is the recipient of the 2016 Whiting Award. He joins me now. Ocean, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Your message that we just heard seems apolitical, not really focused on any one political issue, but really on getting people to know each other better and communicate better.
I would say it is the root of why we engage in political debate, is a common ground. I think when we ask one another, what do you care about? Who do you love? What do you hope for the future? And regardless of where we fall on the political spectrum, we end up in a very similar space, perhaps the same ground that we're standing on, sharing the same values. And I think oftentimes our political discussions fail to arrive there because we begin at such an antagonistic and divisive space. And I just think language is, you know, a tool. And like any other tool, it could be used to make something very useful or it could be used to destroy. And I think when we're more conscious about that, every time we as people speak to one another, we have to make a decision. What do I want to create with the person I'm speaking to? A wall to block them off, or a bridge where I can meet them and understand them better?
And those two images, the wall and the bridge, I mean, there's no way around connecting them to the current campaign. I mean, you said that so much rhetoric lands us in a place where we're divided. It seems to me that a lot of it is intended to do exactly that.
Absolutely. You know, I'm not a political expert. You know, I'm not on the campaign trails. And I think there is a divisiveness does win votes, because the way our democracy is made, it feels like, at least enacted in this moment, is one that is imbued with a bellicose language. We think of battleground states. He or she crushed him or her. And I always wonder, you know, as a writer, how can our democracy survive when we have imbued it with the language of warfare? And I think you're right. We're beginning at already so far from one another, to the point where the only way we can be heard is to shout. But I don't think that's the only way. I think there are other ways that are less explored.
You know, Ocean Vuong, it's true that so much of our politics is imbued with the language of warfare. But another way to look at that is that politics is warfare, right? It's the substitute for warfare. It's what lets us fight out issues without getting on a battlefield and killing each other. So maybe even though it's unpalatable to say battleground states, maybe that's actually a good thing to call it that instead of turning the states into battlegrounds.
Yeah, I mean, it does remind me of a lot of what happened during the Civil War, you know, Buddy Kansas and those states that are actual places of war. But I don't know. I think all thought begins with language, at least the way we live now as human beings, and those thoughts can lead to actions. And I just wonder what would happen if we became less belligerent in thought and language. What would come of that? I think it's an experiment that we have not given a good chance yet here. And I just wonder, I think for me, it's more important when we initiate communication on the personal, everyday level. That's where we have the most power over our own lives as Americans. I think one of the most hurtful political rifts happen in families at the dinner table. And we avoid those conversations like the plague. But I think if we start to ask one another, what are you afraid of? What makes you happy? Who do you love? These questions start to open up channels where we realize that perhaps the person we love is also across the political spectrum from us. And if we start there, it seems inevitable that politics becomes a means to achieve those goals rather than a sort of podium to represent these polarizing ideas.
So while I have you here, then, this is fascinating. It makes me want to try a thought experiment with you.
Yeah.
Maybe to imagine yourself the speechwriter for a second. Donald Trump or his campaign manager comes to you and says, Ocean Vuong, we want to give it a shot. Write my speech for today. I know I'm... Write my speech for today. How would that go?
I think it would begin with that very common ground. Questions are more helpful because a question is an invitation. And I think what happened nowadays is that, particularly in this campaign, is that we are denouncing one another before we get to ask those questions. A question is a door. But if we don't ask the questions, what do you care about? What are your values? Why are you so passionate? Why are you so angry? What are you so afraid of? And I think if we don't ask those carefully, we start to close doors on one another, and we can't afford to do that.
Ocean Vuong is a poet and author, most recently of Night Sky with Exit Wounds. He won the 2016 Whiting Award and also contributed to Poets and Writers Project on Letters to the New President. Ocean Vuong, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. So this was the hottest summer on record. Does that spell terrible things for the global climate? Yes. But does it also spell success for ice cream shops everywhere? You betcha. Next week is the last big week for ice cream counters to turn them out for beachgoers and tourists and everyone else. And that brings us to a very serious decision that everyone confronts. The sweaty high school kid staring at you with a scoop in hand. The line behind you is waiting impatiently. It's time to choose sugar cone or wafer cone. Now let's forget for a second that you can choose a paper cup. These third-party cop-outs do not interest us in this moment. This is a sweet little binary choice. It divides us. It separates us into opposing groups. And the voting isn't in secret. It's right out there in front of everyone. And everyone gets to see what kind of person you are. In your left brain, sugar cone.
I'll pick a
sugar cone.
Sugar cone.
The sugar.
Sugar cone.
Sugar.
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 When you bite into it, it's more fun.
I think it melts faster.
Crunchier. Because it's crispier.
It's much more ice cream here.
I like what the texture becomes as the ice cream kind of soaks into it. It becomes kind of gooey and chewy.
Tastes better.
I don't like wafer cones.
Okay, left brain. In your right brain, wafer cone.
Out of a wafer or a sugar cone, I probably would go wafer.
Wafer cone, for sure.
Wafer.
Wafer cone.
I always go for wafer.
Because you don't need the extra sweetness.
Susan, that was a classic.
It tastes so good. And if it only was vegan.
The texture of it.
I guess maybe because I always had it.
The consistency.
Durable.
They're lighter, they're airier.
I like it better.
When they haven't got one, I take the other because I want the ice cream.
This is a time for choosing. What side are you on? Head over to twitter.com/thetakeaway. You can take our online poll there. So Team Sugar, Team Wafer, this really does divide up the world.
If you do have to divide up the world, that would be the nicest way to do it. I mean, there are lots of really worse alternatives.
That's my guest, Chris Kimball. He's founder of America's Test Kitchen and also founder of Milk Street Kitchen. I had a chance to sit down with Chris and talk about America's sweet but defining choice, sugar versus wafer.
Well, either I've evolved to a higher or lower place, probably the latter, because I just get in a cup at this point because I'm going for the maximum ice cream experience. So I do like a sugar cone. I do like it, the crunch to it. I like the sweetness to it. It probably has molasses or brown sugar in it, so it's got a little bit more flavor. The wafer cones don't have any flavor. And they get that weird, you know, when the ice cream melts, it gets gooey, you know, it changes into some other substance. It's in between liquid and solid, a place you really don't want to be.
Well, where does the modern ice cream cone come from?
It turns out that until the 1800s, they were paper cones, and there were also metal cones, obviously neither of them edible. And then the late 1800s, in Germany, there were reports of edible cones. In this country, very late 1800s, Italian called Marchionne, who invented the first edible cone in New York. He got a patent in 1903, and then the St. Louis World Fair, 1904, a Syrian businessman claims, and this is one of those things like hot dogs, that he was next to an ice cream booth at the fair, and he was making those deep-fried pastries, and he rolled one up in a cone shape and fried it, and then the ice cream vendor put it in a cone. That seems somewhat apocryphal, but in any case—
And at this point, a disappointed child with the ice cream scoop on the ground and sort of the empty cone in their hand is an American archetype.
Yes, or the ice cream cone attached to your forehead. Yes, with a piece of ice cream is also part of the culture as well.
Yeah, again, I do still go for the wafer cone only because of volumetric concerns. I can just get more ice cream. And this may go back, Chris Kimball. The cones we got when I was a little kid were those old-style kind of flavorless little Dixie cup cones. They didn't taste like much. They were sort of yellow and corny. And they didn't hold a lot of ice cream. And maybe that's why I like a great big cone these days.
Yeah, or the cones that had the paper on the outside. Remember those? And you'd take the paper off. Look, it's all about the music, right? I still remember in my neighborhood that there was the ice cream truck. It was all about that big door and the guy in the white suit and standing in line with your quarter. And, you know, anything you want to know about food, it's what you ate as a child. Except I did recently did a Hostess cupcake and I remember them as being my main foodstuff for years, but not quite so good. Looking back, the chocolate flavor was on the de minimis side.
Look, Chris Kimball, you're the guy to ask. Is there any effective way to make your own cones at home? I guess making a super thin waffle and just kind of rolling it up like a cigarette would sort of work.
The question is, why are you doing this? Because you can? Or because you want to. I mean, there are a lot of things in the food where they're like, you can do it, but why would you want to? I mean, now this is why there are ice cream cone factories. I would not go to that trouble. I would make my own ice cream, however. I do that, but I'll buy the cone.
Leave it to the machines and to the experts. There are some things that are better made in a factory after all.
Well, you know, I've tried making puff pastry a few times, either the old-fashioned way or in a food processor, and I've also decided that buying puff pastry is really the way to go. So,
well, Chris Kimball, we've established that you're a sugar cone man. We've established that I'm a wafer cone man for volume reasons. I do have memories of the worst cone available, those little corny kind of flavorless Dixie cup cones when I was a kid also came in a artificially colored sort of rainbow swirl hippie tie-dye fashion. They were gross.
Yeah, but if you're a kid, gross is good. I mean, it's like Pop Rocks are kind of gross, right? I mean, they were pretty good.
Yeah. Again, they tasted like nothing. But yeah, I guess they looked kind of cool. I liked them because they were artificial. We didn't get that. So the kids that had them, I was jealous. Wow, your mom lets you eat artificial things.
Yeah, but look, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Artificial was the cutting edge of food. So the least natural, like blue things, right? Blue food was great. You know, snowballs were great because they were totally unnatural. Anything unnatural and grossly colored and did weird things in your mouth, like popped and sizzled, that was the top of the food pyramid back then.
So let's look into the future before we go. Is there any innovation on the horizon for the cone, or do we stick with tradition? You're either sugar or wafer. You know what you're going to get, and that's kind of what summer ice cream is all about.
Well, there are trends in the ice cream itself, and there are a couple I should just mention. The Thai ice cream roll is the coolest thing ever. You get this wide circle of metal that's super chilled. You put sweet cream on it, and you take like these spackle knives, you know, a couple of them. You can put anything on top, fruit, cookie dough, anything, and you chop and mince until it's all mixed up. They then turn it into they smear it like you would spackle on sheetrock into a big rectangle, let it chill for a few seconds, and then they roll it up on one of these spackle knives, and you get this like cigar roll, and you get five or six of them, and then they put them on end in a cup, and they can put toppings on them. That is really cool. Unnatural, but really cool.
Now, the future of ice cream may, in fact, be the ice cream itself and not the cone. The cone remains traditional and remains a key dividing point among Americans, but a happy one, says Chris Kimball, founder of America's Test Kitchen and founder of Milk Street Kitchen. Great to have you, Chris.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And here's something to take with you today. Imagine waiting in a train station like the massive Penn Station in New York City for your train information to be posted on the big board. I do this all the time, every time I travel to New York to guest host this show. You're waiting to see those numbers and letters flip over to reveal your train. Well, Penn Station announced that it is phasing out its classic departure board, known as a Solari board. Other stations, including 30th Street Station in Philly, abandoning Solari boards too and replacing them with digital. The stations say that Solari software is just too tough to maintain. So say goodbye to that clickety-clack. For the last time, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.